No. Thank you, Eliana, for that introduction, and great to be here with you all. I'm just aware that there wasn't a lot of warning that it was going to be me instead of Kevin tonight. So, but I'm happy to be with you. And Kevin mentored me. I went through the Spirit Rock Community Dharma Leaders Training Program, and he was my mentor. And so he's been kind of very helpful in my teaching career and really just my Buddhist recovery lifestyle or whatever. So happy to step in for him tonight. And I know we start usually with some meditation. So and I'll say just quickly that Kevin is out of retreat. He just did a longer retreat, but he's so recently out that he wasn't quite ready for public speaking, I guess. Got to have that integration period. But I would recommend hearing him as soon as he's speaking again, because I think he had a great retreat, and I'm sure I'll have some wonderful stuff to share. And I did the same retreat last fall, so and so did somebody else here. All right. Anyway, it's just great to share the recovery space with you all and to practice together. So let's go ahead and do some meditation, and we'll have a talk. It's kind of a loosely based on the 12th step talk, kind of around spiritual awakening and helping others from more of a Buddhist perspective, but as related to recovery. So we'll get to that later. But right now, let's go ahead and meditate together, finding that comfortable upright posture, or if you need to lie down or take care of your body, that's perfectly great too. But yeah, just find a way to settle in to your meditation posture. You want to have your back fairly straight and upright, usually, if you're sitting. Allow for You want to be in a position where you can just relax, 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 and cultivate stillness and calmness of body, calmness of mind. So, just noticing there is this body sitting here. You might feel the contact with the chair or cushion, feel the hands in the lap, and feel the feet or the legs. Just establishing mindfulness of the body, the first foundation of mindfulness. And part of that is the breath in the body. So you might also connect with the breath. I usually keep it pretty simple. Breathing in, I know I'm breathing in. Breathing out, I know I'm breathing out. We just take a few moments to really establish this mindfulness of the body, of the breath. And then we might just notice how we're feeling in this moment. Is there a kind of a neutral feeling, or are you feeling upbeat? Is there a pleasant feeling tone to this moment, or maybe we're feeling down, feeling a little weary or something, then it could be a sort of an unpleasant feeling tone. And then we might notice our mind. How busy is the mind? It's pretty normal if it's quite busy at the beginning of a sitting period. We just kind of, I think as we continue to practice, we learn to trust the process of meditation, trust that our busy minds will hopefully gradually settle and calm as we stay connected to the breath and the sense of the body sitting here, and just keep staying with the practice. And part of the idea is that we're aware of thoughts arising and passing away. We try not to get too involved in the thoughts. We don't want to feed these kind of stories and plans that might be arising. We try to stay more in the present moment with the breath and the body. And with sounds, we're aware of the sounds arising and passing away. For the most part, we might kind of leave them in the background for now. Now we just cultivate a sense of peace, calm, ease. Nowhere else we need to be right now, nothing else we need to be doing, no other role we need to take on, just sitting, being with the breath. And doing this with an attitude of kindness and compassion for ourselves that we can then extend to everyone here if we wish. And also meeting if something, some difficult memory arises or just an emotion, we meet that with kindness as well. Not trying to push anything away. Welcoming whatever's here. It's not a mistake, and we don't need to make it a problem. Just meet it with mindfulness, compassion, care. Might even put a hand on the heart, hand on the belly, and just hold ourselves, befriend ourselves in this moment. Whenever we get lost in a compelling story or plan for later, we just, whenever we notice it, we see that as a moment of mindfulness reestablished, and we gently come back to the next breath when we're ready. No need to beat ourselves up just because we got lost in thought. One last practice I'd like to offer is a short gratitude practice. I've been told this can be helpful for a busy mind, helps the mind relax and calm down. If we can just think of a few simple things we're grateful for in this moment. I'm grateful to be clean and sober today. I'm grateful for Ileana and the support of Spirit Rock for this Dharma and Recovery gathering tonight. I'm grateful to me. Wife for putting our daughter to bed so I can be with you all. So we just think of a few things we're grateful for, and then we let that go, return to the following the breath or whatever your regular practice is. Everything I'm offering is just a suggestions. If you have a your own way that you prefer to practice, of course, go with that. Well, you might just check in, notice if you're lost on a story train, you're running way down the tracks. See if you can decouple the train, bow to it, return to the next breath, reconnect with that sense of this body sitting here. Not that there's anything wrong with remembering stories, but in the practice where you want to cultivate a non-distracted mind, this takes training. So this is part of the training. Often for myself, what I get caught by is planning a future pleasant experience. So noticing when we're doing that seems to be a habit of my mind. So we again we meet these things with kindness. We're like, oh, there goes another plan for a pleasant experience. And we can even, have a sense of humor about it and let it go because it's taking us out of this present moment, this breath. The good news is there is something called the subtle joy of being in the present moment. So it's possible to connect with a wholesome type of joy of just being in the here and now in an undistracted way. So we start to look for that as a way to keep us on the path. Stay with the meditation. hopefully you could hear the bell. Great. I love there's a musician's setting in Zoom. And I guess we don't usually take a break in this group, so, but if you need to take care of yourself, obviously, please do. But we're gonna move ahead. And let me know if for any reason you can't hear me, I'll try to speak up. So again, my name is Walt, and I'm located in Berkeley, California at the moment, and I use he, him pronouns, and I'm going to offer some reflections. We'll probably go till about 9 o'clock tonight, and then, but we'll have some time to for questions and sharing as well, so I look forward to hearing from some of you. And I just want to say it's great to see the people. Those of you I know, it's wonderful to see familiar faces, and it's also wonderful to meet new friends. And so it's great to be here with you, and I'll try to be louder. Let's see. The only thing I can say is that my sound is up as high as it goes. Is that better? No? It's interesting, because this happened recently where most people could hear fine and some people couldn't. So I'm not, it may be beyond my control. I'm trying. Okay, how about now? Is it, it's good, okay. All right, so here we are. kind of bringing together our recovery, presumably from some form of addiction, alcohol addiction, drug addiction, could be all kinds of things, process addictions, gambling, sex, who knows. I know that I'm pretty addictive. I really need a lot of support, because left to my own, I can really, get caught up in stuff. So I'm grateful to the Buddhist path for really teaching me mindfulness and this ability to stay present and not get caught in cravings and things. And tonight I thought I would talk about, because it's the 12th month, I thought I would kind of talk not too heavily about the 12th step, but touch on the 12th step in 12-step recovery, and then relate that to Buddhist, kind of how we would see that in Buddhist terms. The 12th step, and for those who may not know, is having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, meaning all the previous 11 steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics, addicts, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So all the principles we've learned in the previous steps, we're trying to carry them forward. And, I do kind of like this step, which is probably why I'm talking about it. I like some of the traditional 12-step language around it. For example, in the 12 and 12 book from AA, it says, when a man or a woman or a person has a spiritual awakening, they have been granted a gift which amounts to a new state of consciousness and being. They've been set on a path which tells them they are really going somewhere, that life is not a dead end, not something to be endured or mastered. I really like that, because so at the end of my drinking, my last binge was ended in waking up in jail out of a blackout. And not only that, but I sort of had a near-death experience or something right before waking up in jail. So my whole life flashed before my eyes. I have a vivid memory of that. I was alcohol poisoning. It was very close to, I could have died. And what was interesting is the sort of vision of my life flashing before my eyes, it ended in like a dead end, like it ended in hitting a black wall. And I kind of had this message from the universe, if you stay on the path you're on now of, continuing to drink and use, you're on a dead end. It was just very clear my life was on a dead end. And not only that, the reason I was in jail is because I had gotten into my car. It's a long, I actually, earlier in the evening, my friend drove me to the bar. So I was sort of like, oh, I shouldn't drive. I've already had a couple too many or whatever. But then unfortunately, my friend gave me my car keys back and then disappeared. I think he was just in front of the bar and I didn't know where he went. And so then I got cut off at the bar because I kept drinking and drinking. And they're like, you don't need any more. And then they ended up throwing me out of the bar. I don't remember this, but I pieced it all together. And unfortunately, I didn't know what to do, so I got in my car and drove away. And the point of this story is I crashed my car into a parked truck on a dead-end street. So I literally was on a dead end, not literally and figuratively. So I just thought that was sort of perfect languaging that they're saying that we're realizing in recovery that life is not a dead end. It's not just something to be endured or mastered. And I like that too, because at that point in my life, even when I wasn't drinking, I was sort of white knuckling it. It really felt like I was just enduring life. I wasn't thriving, Things were not going so well. So I just kind of found this language interesting. And then it goes on to say that we've found a possession of a degree of honesty, tolerance, unselfishness, peace of mind, and love of which we had thought ourselves quite incapable. Or at least I didn't know for myself that it was really available to me because I wasn't experiencing it, until I landed in recovery after that night in jail and everything. I went to treatment and got help, found out about addiction and alcoholism, or now they have a different term for alcoholism. What is it? But you know what I mean. So there's that. And then I also looked at the NA book, Narcotics Anonymous. And they have some interesting, very simple language around this 12th step. They say, we came to NA as the result of the wreckage of the past. The last thing we expected was an awakening of the spirit. We just wanted to stop hurting. I really like that too, because that's kind of, I can relate. And yeah, I wasn't really looking to get thrown on some kind of spiritual path, right? I was just, as they're saying, I was just hurting. And then that ended up being what happened. And then it goes on to say the steps lead to an awakening of a spiritual nature. This awakening is evidenced by changes in our lives. These changes make us better able to live by spiritual principles and to carry our message of recovery and hope to the addict who still suffers. The message, however, is meaningless until we live it. As we live it, our lives and actions give it more meaning than our words and literature ever could. I think that's important. And then lastly, from the NA book, it just says all spiritual awakenings have some things in common, such as an end to loneliness and a sense of direction in our lives. Many of us believe that a spiritual awakening is meaningless unless accompanied by an increase in peace of mind and concern for others. In order to maintain peace of mind, it says, we strive to live in the here and now. So now you might know why I wanted to read that, because I love that they say we strive to live in the here and now, which is what I'm all about with our mindfulness practice. It's really goes well kind of with Buddhist teachings. All of that to me works pretty well. I mean, you may or may not like this word spiritual, which somehow we don't use that word a lot in Buddhism, but I can still relate to it in different ways. And certainly you some of you may have thoughts about this later, which I'm happy to hear. For now, I'll just keep talking. But anyway, so I think this is all really important, and I know for me, I did have some kind of spiritual awakening. I just realized I was on that dead-end path, and I needed to change my life. I guess I became willing to do whatever it took, because I knew that my way wasn't working too well, because I had done blackout drinking and terrible hangovers long enough. And I was still pretty young, but I was already sick and tired of being sick and tired. And things did change, but for me, part of my story is that then I sort of hit a wall when I was like 16 years clean and sober, and that's when I went through a divorce. I was unemployed, felt kind of unemployable for a while, just wasn't in a good space. And then I thought, well, I'd already been introduced to Buddhist teachings and I'd been dabbling with it. But at that point, I said, it just occurred to me, I need to do something different. And I had heard Jack Kornfield talk about these retreats, but I'd never really explored them. And I thought, I should go on a retreat and see what that's all about. So I finally went on my first retreat because I was miserable enough in recovery to give it a try. And that ended up changing my life. Because it just really, I guess something was missing for me in my recovery until I really connected with the insight meditation practice, and the teachings from early Buddhism in particular have become very meaningful to me. And one of the things is I had heard about mindfulness and I had tried to practice it, but when I went on retreat, I call going on retreat going pro with mindfulness, because I was trying before I went on retreat, but it just, I don't think I really got it. But when that's all you're doing all day for multiple days in a row, then at some point you sort of start to get it a little bit, hopefully. And it may, some for some of us it might be quicker, some of us it might be slower, but for me it sort of, I got it fairly quickly once I went on retreat. And you know, still learning about it too, but and also started to really value it. That might be the other part of it. And also my mind calmed down enough. The other thing is, when I first got into recovery, my mind was really unwieldy. And I always talk about how one sign of that was just that, and this is a long time ago, we got styrofoam coffee cups, you know, the styrofoam. And at the end of every meeting, my styrofoam coffee cup would be just a pile of little styrofoam bits, because I would have chewed it to just tiny bits, and it would just be this kind of embarrassing pile that I would have to like put in my hands and take to the trash can. I don't know. And then I realized that I was making progress in recovery when I, you know, one day looked at my coffee cup at the end of the meeting, and it just had like a big bite mark in it, but it wasn't a pile of little bits. I had still bit it for some reason. So I don't know what that's all about. I don't use styrofoam anymore. That's actually illegal in Berkeley, apparently. But nonetheless, I always thought that was interesting. So I knew I was making some progress. All right. Well, so then for me, you know, a lot of Buddhist teachings just kind of reinforce what we just read. But also, you know, living in the here and now always sounded good to me. And even in high school, my high school tennis coach, who was an ex-hippie kind of interested in meditation, he made us read a book like The Inner Game of Tennis, which was about, you know, mindfulness in tennis or something. And so I was trying. I was like, how can I? But at the same time, I was terrible at tennis because of my mind, you know, that I would kind of like panic when the big points came. That that kind of thing, because I didn't know how to really be present. I thought about it too much. So then I discovered Buddhist practice, went on my first couple of retreats, and really it started to click for me. And I thought I would share this. I love this kind of teaching from Joseph Goldstein in his book Mindfulness. He says, "What is mindfulness? It is the opposite of absent-mindedness. It's paying attention to what is happening at this very moment as it is happening, without being lost in thoughts or stories or opinions about how it should be. Mindfulness acts as the guardian of the sense doors because it keeps us aware of what is arising through the senses and helps us not to get lost in the proliferation of desires." And he ends it by saying, "When mindfulness is present, we abide more peacefully in our lives." I love that line. When mindfulness is present, we abide more peacefully in our lives. And it said in that NA reading that I did, it said that one of the things spiritual awakenings have in common is, an increase in peace of mind. And then also concern for others, because we're not, we've stopped being so self-concerned, and we're able to start to have more concern for others. And so I always think it's just good to kind of remember what the teachings say about mindfulness. One teacher, Venerable Annalio, Bhikkhu Annalio, he's a German Buddhist monk. He talks about how mindfulness, the original word sati, the Pali word that we use for mindfulness, or that we define as mindfulness, it was related to memory in the ancient Indian language. And he says that one aspect of that is when we're really being mindful, it enhances our memory. That we'll be more likely, because if you're really present and your mind isn't too distracted, then you'll remember what happened, right? And it's just interesting because one of the aspects of my, if you want to call it disease, my alcoholism in particular, was blacking out and having zero memory about what had happened. And I remember one day I was on a college campus where I kind of did a lot of my low bottom drinking. And I had been at some major party all night the night before, and I went to the gym to try to like sweat it out. And there was a woman working behind the cage, like the cage is where they hand out like basketballs or whatever. And so that person saw me coming, and they're like, "Walt, it's Walt, my new best friend. We talked for hours last night." And I literally just had no memory of ever even meeting this person, which was really kind of, disturbing. So these days I've really come to value this idea of like being present and really remembering what happens. So he says, Bhikkhu Annalio says, "Full awareness of the present moment will make it easier to recall later what happened." And I think that's just kind of interesting. And he also says mindfulness is a mental quality that we have to bring into being, or that we have to establish ourselves. And we don't force this. It's an open, receptive awareness. But I really like that too, that mindfulness has to be established. It doesn't just happen on its own, right? And somehow that's a good reminder for me that I have to establish mindfulness. And then the last thing is that he just quotes, he says, "The Buddha stated that mindfulness is always useful, always useful." So basically, I challenge you to come up with a scenario where mindfulness wouldn't be useful. And then basically, the Buddha said that there is no circumstance where mindfulness wouldn't be useful. All right, so that's just a little bit about mindfulness. and living in the here and now, which I've really come to appreciate more and more. And it's amazing because when, especially on retreat, I was on this 6 week retreat last fall, and it was just interesting just being present. I could be, I spent a fair amount of time kind of just in the woods behind IMS and whatever, but it was just like I could just be sitting on a rock and nothing happening and just being fully present sitting on that rock. There was just something really wonderful about it. I didn't need anything else in that moment. And I actually found this one rock that I started going to that nobody else knew about. It was my special rock out in the woods. But anyway, so yeah, the beauty of this is it's so simple. We can really just begin to appreciate being alive. There's a Zen saying, just to be alive is enough. But maybe in our tradition, we'd say just to be mindful is enough. I don't know, or just to be here and now is enough. But so then, we practice mindfulness, we practice, recovery in whatever way that we're practicing recovery. For me, it's abstinence of drugs and alcohol, and I'm not able to do abstinence of sugar yet, but I've greatly reduced sugar in my life. Sugar became an issue for me. So yeah, we have to keep refining what we need to. So mindfulness helps us with that too, like realizing, oh, when I eat too much sugar, I do not feel good. It's not like it tastes great, but it does not, my body is not liking it. And so when we can really feel that and be honest about it, we can start to live more wisely. So, and there's also something called clearly knowing or sampajanya in the Pali. And this is, so it's often kind of, it's not just mindful. So we need to be not only mindful, but we need to have clear comprehension with mindfulness. They kind of go together. Joseph Goldstein says, this is the ability to clearly comprehend what is taking place, knowing what we're doing and why is a profound and transforming practice, Joseph says. It highlights the understanding that mindfulness is more than simply being present. With clear comprehension, we know the purpose and appropriateness of what we're doing. We understand the motivations behind our actions. And that's powerful too. And it kind of goes with what some of that 12-step literature said about how we have, I think it says something about we have a direction in our lives. Where did that go? Yeah, that we have a sense of direction in our lives. And I feel like when we have mindfulness and clear comprehension, we have that direction very clearly. So for me, Buddhism kind of, it just it kind of even refines my understanding of what that might mean to have direction in my life. Like it always sounds good, but how do I actually do it? And for me, the Buddhist teachings and practices have given me a real clear sense of how that might manifest in my own life in a way that I can follow it. So, and then thought I would mention, because spiritual awakening is kind of an interesting term. And I know for me, when I used to hear that term, I thought it meant some big experience, right? And maybe it does, I'm not. Some people could say it does. And it's interesting because, we can. I've done a lot of meditation retreats. So I have had some interesting meditative experiences. I'm not going to go into details, but I've certainly had them. But it's Bhikkhu Anālayo, who's become one of my main teachers, these days. He says in one of his books, special experiences certainly have their place in meditation, but they are not the goal itself. The goal is rather inner transformation. Meditation practice should result in an improvement in the way we are, how we relate to others, and how we deal with outer circumstances. Such internal changes are more important than appropriating spectacular experiences as markers of our meditative expertise. Part of me is slightly disappointed by that. You know, it's like, but I had this great experience in, 2007. But it is true. It's like, even if you have some great meditative experience, where is it now? You know, it doesn't really last like everything else. But at the same time, we can have what he's pointing to, this inner transformation. And certainly, like, people have noticed that I've known long term. They're like, one of my friends said one day, "Where did your anger go, Walt? What happened? What did you do?" Because I just didn't, I had sort of had some anger issues. And they just kind of, over time, with a lot of practice, it just kind of hasn't been a big problem over the last number of years. And I definitely, I can't say, all I did was basically really apply the Buddhist teachings in my life, and it really seems to work. So Bhikkhu Anuluddha goes on, because I really like what he says here. He says, of particular importance is in relation to such personal transformation, I believe, is a genuine opening of the heart to the qualities of kindness and compassion. So the real measure of spiritual awakening is, are we kinder and more compassionate? And then he says, in my personal view, such opening of the heart is a better measuring rod for progress in our practice than having extraordinary experiences. In order to encourage this dimension of practice, and also as a way of mirroring the Buddha's own unswerving quest for awakening, I suggest introducing a formal element of setting our intention at the beginning of each formal sitting. This could be an aspiration like, may I progress on the path to liberation for my own benefit and for the benefit of others. And this is something that he brings in when you take a course with him, that he thinks it's a great idea right when you're beginning your a sit, like tonight, that we would say something like, may I make progress on the path of liberation for my own benefit and also for the benefit of other beings. Now that's one version. You could make it up, it could be like for the benefit of my recovery and the recovery of everybody that I know. You could reword it any way you want, but the idea is that there should be a dimension of caring about others, and that we're not just practicing for ourselves. And he also says, simply said, we are not just practicing for ourselves, we are also practicing for the sake of others. Awareness of this external dimension of our meditation practice makes it easier to withstand any onslaught of doubt and frustration. And that's really interesting, that when we're very clearly, we know we're not just practicing for ourselves, but we know that we're practicing for others too. That if we get into a tough spot, it's actually helps us get through it to keep thinking, well, I can't let these folks down that I'm also hoping to benefit with my practice. I will say, it was in my bio that I've done a lot of, I've volunteered as a Buddhist teacher in prisons for the past 10 years roughly, although COVID interrupted it for a while. And so I was on that retreat last fall, and I guess I knew that when I got out of that retreat I was going to go back to the prison, because I hadn't been back during COVID, something like that. But I just remember I was really, while I was practicing, I was really aware of the guys that I had worked with in this one particular prison, and that I was really looking forward to seeing them again. And I felt like somehow, hopefully, my practice was also would also benefit them, or there was just a connection there that did kind of help me through any the difficult points. during that period of practice. So I really like that idea, and it I'm going to kind of get to this connection of, you know, recovery as well, like that. But there's another quote I like right now that's from Father Greg Boyle, who wrote this book, Tattoos on the Heart. I'm sure you've heard of that one. The Power of Boundless Compassion is the subtitle. And he says, Mother Teresa diagnosed the world's ills in this way, that we've just, quote, forgotten that we belong to each other. Kinship is what happens when we refuse to let that happen. With kinship as the goal, other essential things fall into place. Without it, no justice, no peace. He adds, I suspect that were kinship our goal, we would no longer be promoting justice, we would be celebrating it. But I love this idea of kinship. And I think for me, when I was sort of drinking and using, I did not have a strong sense of kinship. It was more like, where do I get my, you know, drugs and alcohol kind of thing. And, but in recovery, certainly there's real kinship among fellow sufferers in recovery, fellow. But then I like in Buddhism, it's, you know, we're expanding that with kinship with all beings is kind of the goal. So it kind of just keeps getting wider and wider, the circle of kinship. But I will say that, you know, the kinship I feel with people in recovery is pretty strong and has really carried me in my years of recovery. And something else Venerable Inalio brings up that I wanted to share was, well, he brings up, so there's this, you know, compassion is a big, is a high value target in Buddhism, right? That we're cultivating compassion. The practice, like he said, with the opening of the heart, as we keep practicing, there's going to naturally more compassion will flow. And the Buddha would say that he taught out of compassion, which is kind of a, you know, that I like that way of describing that, and that, you know, that he would, the I guess Mara, who's kind of like the Buddhist tempter, was messing with Buddha one day, and trying to say, you know, who do you think you are? Yeah, being a teacher and things like that. And the Buddha said, that he engaged in his teaching activities, that for him it was not any form of bondage. I guess the Mara might have been insinuating that. But for him, teaching was simply an expression of his compassion. And he said one should not teach. But anyway, so it's the same thing. And then he also said one should not teach with the wish to inspire listeners so that they make offerings to oneself. Instead, the proper way to teach is when one is just motivated by the wish to benefit others. And then Bhikkhu Nalio goes on to say, early Buddhist compassion requires a carefully maintained balance between concern for others and purifying oneself. This is illustrated in a simile of two acrobats who perform together. To perform successfully, they need to establish their own balance as a basis for being able to take care of each other. So there's this famous sutta about these two acrobats. Have you all heard that one before? Yeah, some of you have. So I thought I might share a little bit of it. It's kind of a funny story. It's a traditional teaching that I've had a lot of teachers bring it up, but I have not actually talked about it before, so I thought I would share it tonight. And it just, so on one occasion, the Blessed One, the Buddha, was dwelling among the Sambhas, certain people in certain town, and then he, I guess he tells this story. He says he's talking to some bhikkhus. Apparently, bhikkhu could be monastics, but it could also just be any sincere practitioners or followers of the Buddha. So we could be a bhikkhu. And so he says, bhikkhus once in the past, an acrobat set up his bamboo pole and addressed his apprentice thus. And the apprentice's name, I can't even pronounce it. It's a Middakathilika or something. But what it actually literally meant or means is frying pan, which I think is hilarious. So this person's name is Frying Pan. And I think it's kind of like small fry, probably, like we would say small fry. It's probably like a really short person because they're easily put on a pole for this acrobat thing. And they actually say that they don't know what gender this person was. So maybe it was even a trans person, or we don't know. But anyway, so the sort of main, the head acrobat says to his apprentice Frying Pan, climb the bamboo pole and stand on my shoulders. And having replied, that person says, yes, teacher. And then the apprentice climbs up the bamboo pole and stood on the teacher's shoulders. And the acrobat then said to the apprentice Frying Pan, you protect me, dear Frying Pan, and I'll protect you. Thus, guarded by one another, protected by one another, we'll display our skills, collect our fee, and get down safely from the bamboo pole. But when this was said, the apprentice, Frying Pans, replied, that's not the way to do it, teacher. You protect yourself, and I'll protect myself. Thus, each self-guarded and self-protected will display our skills, collect our fee, and get down safely from the bamboo pole. And the Buddha says, that's the method there. It's just as the apprentice, Frying Pan, said. I will protect myself. And then the Buddha says, bhikkhus, thus should the establishments of mindfulness be practiced. The four foundations of mindfulness. I will protect others, bhikkhus, thus should the establishments of mindfulness be practiced. Protecting oneself, one protects others. Protecting others, one protects oneself. And how is it that by protecting oneself, one protects others? By the pursuit, development, and cultivation of the four establishments of mindfulness. It is in such a way that by protecting oneself, one protects others. And there's just a little more. He says, and how is it that by protecting others, one protects oneself? By patience, harmlessness, loving kindness, and sympathy. It is in such a way that by protecting others, one protects oneself. So just I think that's interesting, and it kind of relates to recovery because we have to take care of our own recovery first before we can really be a whole lot of help to others. And it reminded me of a story when I was in early recovery that I would like to tell where. So I was living in a small town, like a college town on the East Coast in Virginia, and I was in my first maybe 4 or 5 months of recovery, and I was also newly out of college, but I had gone to college in a different town, but I was found myself. I went to treatment in this one town, and then got out and decided to live there. And but one of my best friends that I grew up partying with my whole life was going to that school that I was now living in his that town. And I ran into him in town one day. It was like Friday afternoon, and he said, "Oh," and he knew where I lived because I lived in this apartment building right off campus. And he said, "Oh, there's a huge party at the house next to your apartment building on Saturday night, and I'm going to be there. Why don't you come over and we'll hang out because we haven't hung out for a while." And he knew I was trying to be in recovery, but I don't think he cared at all. Like he was right. He was in the still partying hard at that point. And so I was kind of like, yeah, good to see you, goodbye. But then, so then that Saturday night came and I went to a meeting and then I went out with people after the meeting, 12-step meeting. But then eventually I went home, right? And it was like 11 o'clock at night because recovery people are like, all right, I gotta go to bed. So I go home and, well, this is like a typical college party, right? It was just starting to rage at 11 o'clock, right? And my apartment building, it was a, I think it was a warm summer night, so my windows were up or were open, and you could just really hear the party, and it sounded like, you know, quite a party. And my inner addict was like, well, I'm invited to that party. I could go to that party right now. And it was like, I know somebody that's going to be there. And so it was just kind of like I was in a little bit of a dodgy spot because part of me really wanted to go to this party. Fortunately, I had just enough recovery to remember that you're supposed to call somebody when you get into a tight spot. Because I knew if I went to that party, there's no way I wasn't going to use. Because my buddy, if I ran into him, we had such a history of partying together that there's just it would have been hard to resist. So anyway, I remembered that this guy that I had met at a sober poker game the previous weekend, and I thought he had a good sense of humor. And he'd given me his phone number, so I called him, and fortunately he answered the phone, and I told him what was happening. And I kind of think of this as like the Acrobats a little because it was like, his recovery was stable. He'd been in recovery longer. And mine was shaky, and I needed some help protecting myself in a way. And so I told him what was going on, and his response was, "Do you know how to play backgammon?" And I said, "No, I've never played backgammon in my life." And he said, "Well, come over to my apartment," and he gave me the address or whatever, "and I'll teach you how to play." So then I went over to his place rather than sitting there listening to the party noise for the next. And he taught me how to play backgammon. And then that became a lifelong friendship. I just hung out with, he lives in Washington State, but I just spent a long weekend with him up there a few weeks ago. But that was 35 plus years ago. But I really think that he kind of saved my life, or at least saved me that night from relapsing. So I really like that sort of story about the Acrobats in a way that because he had taken care of himself and his recovery, and I was trying to take care of mine, but I needed a little extra support that night. So then this kind of brings us to how we help each other in recovery. But also in Buddhist teachings, it's really also about compassion for ourselves and then compassion for other beings, and that we try to serve others as in any way we can. And there's a quote that I ran across from Kittasaro and Tanisara. These are these they were it was a Buddhist monk and a Buddhist nun in the Ajahn Chah tradition, and they met as monastics and fell in love. And then they both disrobed, and now they've been married and together as a couple for many, many years. It's kind of a great story, and they're very deep teachers. They have a book called Listening to the Heart, and their main teacher was Ajahn Chah. So they say, Ajahn Chah advised, "Don't think you have a 10-wheeler truck when you have a wheelbarrow. Holding skillful boundaries is an act of compassion for oneself, and it is with the self that we must start. As we work through our own suffering, our ability to help others becomes more effective. We then begin to know fulfillment. The Buddha himself recognized the need to serve after his awakening. He realized that those who have nothing to serve live unhappily. In wondering about this, he concluded that the optimum service is to the Dharma. To live fully, we need something beyond ourselves to serve. This keeps the heart content and grateful. It helps us feel a joyful connection with the flow of life. So I think we know this, right? But I just sort of nice to hear the words. And certainly it's been true in my life. Anytime I've done some kind of service, I feel like I get so much out of it. And it gives me that sense of, that they're talking about here, the sense of purpose, something, and a sense of fulfillment in a way when we really feel like maybe we're helping make a difference. So I do this prison work, and we sometimes do day-longs in prison, which is pretty amazing, because you really, it's like a day-long retreat in a prison, and you really get to practice pretty deeply with folks. And so one day we did a whole day of practice for many hours, and really a beautiful time together. And then at the end of it, we like to have a circle and go around, and everybody kind of just share like how the experience was for them. And I'll just never forget, because this guy, we get to him, and he's just kind of beaming, you know. He's like really had a great experience, and he says, "I assume," and he's talking to, there were like three or four volunteers, including me, and he says, "I assume that you all volunteer to do this to make a difference in people's lives." And he says, "Well, let me tell you, you are making a difference in people's lives." And just the way he said it was so moving, you know. He's like, "You are making a difference in people's lives." And I'm not taking credit for any, you know, but it was like just so, such a beautiful moment to hear him, the way he said that. And you just felt the passion with the way he said it. So that was a beautiful moment. And yeah, so it really, I'll also say anecdotally that, well, I just know that I've learned the power of service from being in recovery. And then I'm just always amazed that in the Buddhist world, because I worked at a Buddhist center and then I teach at different centers, and very often some of the most dedicated volunteers, I often find out they're also in recovery. This is just anecdotal, but I think that's really kind of cool. You'll be like, yeah, it's just amazing how many times that's happened. So I think that we do in recovery, we learn the beauty of being of service in whatever way we can. And I used to lead, I lived in Seattle, and I led took a meeting to some kind of detox, like a King County detox center. And you just heard these very dramatic stories about people waking up in phone booths, and I don't know, it just really heard some intense stories in this city, this county detox. But when I look back on it, it was like it enhanced my own recovery so much. It's like there's no way I was going to go out and drink and use after listening to some of the stories of what the folks were going through in detox. And but also it just felt good to show up and try to be of service to them. And the other part of this is that we don't know what the outcome is going to be, right? We learn that, you know, you can't, we have to also develop what's called in Buddhism equanimity, that ultimately people have to take responsibility for their own actions and their own recovery. And so we do whatever we can to support them, but we can't always save them. So we also have to be prepared for that we're not fully in control of the outcome. And, you know, we might say that they have their own karma. I had a close friend relapse after 20 years of recovery, and helped him get into treatment. He called me one day and said, "Walt, I need help." And I literally thought he was talking about like he needed to move and he wanted me to help him move at first, because he wasn't explaining why he needed help. And he'd relapsed, but he was hiding his drinking so well that I was starting to hear rumors that maybe he had, but whenever I saw him, he always wanted to meet in the morning. For me, it was like, let's have coffee. And now, you know, then I realized why later, but he just was really good at hiding it for a number of years. But then one day he finally called me and said, I need help. And then I took him to see my sponsor because I felt like I needed help helping him. And then we got him that day. It was pretty amazing. We went to breakfast, and then my sponsor said, well, I think you need to check into a treatment center because it sounds, you know, he told us some details. And so that day he let me take him to a treatment center. I really didn't think he would actually go through with it, but he did, and he got back into recovery for a while, but then he relapsed again. And then we got him back into another treatment center, and then he relapsed again. And then eventually he drank himself to death. So that was really rough. That was a couple year and a half ago. But and there, you know, I there just was only so much I could do. So yeah, there's that too, that we have to also, again, we do have to protect ourselves, and we try to help and protect others. But you know, that's one of the challenges of being in recovery is that it doesn't always end well, right? We see a lot of so I'll this is kind of a heavy subject to end on, but contemplation of death has been a very important teaching for me as well. And this teacher I've mentioned already tonight, Bhikkhu Anolio, he just did a year-long retreat by himself in Massachusetts. And he said he spent the whole time focusing on contemplation of death, which I'd love to know how that what that actually looked like. But he already sleeps in a coffin. This is how he's already so devoted to the contemplation of death that his bed is built to look like a coffin. It's not a real coffin, but it's built so that, you know, you're reminded of a coffin. And he just really wants that to be forefront in his mind. And for me, it is a strong motivator in my recovery that this contemplation of death as well. That part of it is, if I really do believe if I went back out and started drinking and using again, I'd probably end up like my friend in some way or other. But also, I might harm others along the way, which I don't want to do. But also, we don't know how much time we have, and I kind of just appreciate being alive today and being present for it. And so the real purpose of, he says, Bhikkhu Anolio says contemplation of death brings him a tremendous amount of joy, which sounds very counterintuitive, I know. But I think that's kind of interesting. And I don't know if I'm quite there yet, but it does help me stay in the present, and it helps me practice every day because I feel like if I were going to die today, and I don't know, we don't know when we're going to die, right? There's no way to really know. And but I know that I want to meditate the day I die, if at all possible. So it kind of helps me like hit the cushion every day while I can, because for me, that I want to kind of have a peaceful mind when I go out. And it's not that crazy that we really could go at any time. I was taking a walk with my daughter, this is a couple months ago now, and it was sort of like dusk. I mean, there was plenty of light, but it was dusk-ish. And we were walking along kind of a main street in Berkeley, but there was like a hill. And all of a sudden, this deer, this pretty huge deer, just came flying down the hill and went right in front of us by, I mean, I had to pull my daughter back, and it just was going so fast. And we were on a sidewalk, and there were these steep steps on the other side of the sidewalk, and the deer leaped all the way down these steep steps from where we were. But if the deer had hit us, it could have knocked us down those steps. Who knows? It could have been really tragic. And it just happened like that, you know? It was like one moment we're having this lovely, leisurely walk, and the next moment this crazy deer came out of nowhere and almost slammed into us. So, just to say, you don't know. All right, well, I've talked enough. Thank you for your kind attention. And with all that, I'll just love to hear from anybody who wants to share or ask any kind of question, and I'll be happy to respond.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.